Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For the second time in nearly 3 weeks, a Central Ohio law enforcement officer has shot and killed a black man. A Columbus police officer was responding to a non-emergency noise complaint early Tuesday morning when he shot a man outside a Northwest Columbus home. The officer has been identified as Adam Coy, an 18-year veteran of the force. The victim's name has not been released. Adam Coy has been suspended with pay from the force. Mayor Andrew Ginther spoke yesterday about the rash of killings nationwide this year.
We are still raw from the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and less than 3 weeks ago, Casey Goodson Jr. Early this morning, we learned of the killing of another African American at the hands of law enforcement. Our community is exhausted.
WSU reporter Nick Evans has been following the story. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. And Columbus Dispatch reporter Bethany Bruner. Welcome back, Bethany.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
Bethany, the police shooter has been suspended with pay from the Division of Police. He has been identified. The victim has not. When do we expect more details?
We're expecting to get a lot of new information later today, including the victim's name. We're also expecting to see that body camera footage that has been talked about in the last 24 hours. We're expecting to see that at some point this afternoon, probably late afternoon.
What do we know about Adam Coy, Nick Evans? Anything? He's an 18-year veteran of the force, or is one.
Right. Well, you know, there has been past reporting, the dispatch in particular got this, you know, where he was seen aggressively, bashing a person's head into a car during a traffic stop, you know, going through the officer complaints from Internal Affairs. I mean, I've just been kind of combing through this over the past couple of minutes. And I mean, like, it looks as though, I mean, there's 100 different complaints, but there are multiple complaints that can come from a single incident. It looks as though there's 40 plus incidents going back to 2002 where, you know, there has been some sort of complaint raised. You know, those have been sometimes sustained, sometimes withdrawn, sometimes not sustained, or with this, that, and the other. But, you know, there's certainly, you know, been something of a checkered past. I mean, he has been suspended in the past. He has gone through constructive training because of some of these complaints.
And Bethany, that number of complaints, is that unusual? Does that raise your eyebrows?
It definitely does raise your eyebrows. But again, you have to consider how many of those are actually sustained complaints versus someone upset that they got a traffic ticket for speeding. That's always something we have to look at with a grain of salt, depending on any particular officer's their particular patrol position, their particular detective position. Those can always play a role in that. So it's not necessarily surprising, but it definitely is something that's worth looking into more.
It was a noise complaint, which is considered a non-emergency call. It could be somebody playing their music too loud. In this case, it was this 47-year-old unidentified man turning a car on and off, which sounds like he was warming it up, then turning it off. He was waiting in his car for something. Who knows? No gun was found, but there's this issue about his left hand was holding a cell phone, and his right hand, it says, it was not visible. What does that mean? I mean, was it in his pocket? Do we know?
So what we don't know is where that hand was. That's going to be on that body camera footage. But what we also don't know is what was said in the interim. Were there commands to show us your hand? And did that person, this man, not comply with that? Was it this person saying, I have a gun in my pocket? We don't know. And we aren't going to know that with the body camera footage either, because of the way that technology works. There's not going to be audio. We'll just see the video. And that's something we may never know what actually was said during that interaction.
But, you know, Nick Evans, there was a witness. It was the other police officer, right?
Right. You know, there certainly was. But again, you know, body camera not on. The dash cam apparently was not turned on because they didn't turn on their lights. I think that, you know, one of the things that we should keep in mind, we won't know what was said. But I think that, you know, when we look back at how a lot of these interactions have gone, I mean, with respect, the idea to, you know, even throw out there the possibility that, you know, the person said, "I have a gun," is I find incredibly unlikely when, you know, you have a African-American man in the middle of the night being approached by two police officers with guns drawn. I mean, we won't know what was said, but, you know, I think it's fairly unlikely that it was, you know, really aggressive. You know, I mean, like, I think that that's sort of what you heard in the anger and the frustration that Mayor Ginther was putting out there yesterday. You know, we have these cameras for a reason, and they weren't used. And, you know, that would have cleared all of this up. And this is also the argument that we constantly hear from the police and from the sheriff's department when they recently got funding for cameras of their own. You know, these are tools that vindicate us. And yet in this instance, they simply weren't used. And so we won't know. I mean, I think it's really, really frustrating for a lot of folks to have that, you know, sort of, you know, hanging over this, that lack of ability to sort out what actually happened.
We're going to have an expert on the police use of body camera technology joining us later on in the program. But for now, Bethany Bruner, what is the police policy for the use of the body cameras?
So police policy is pretty explicit that you have to have it turned on in any response to a call for service.
Any response.
Priority one or priority two call. So those are emergency calls, you know, you're going lights and sirens to something, but also those non-emergency calls, you're supposed to have it on. There are exceptions made for when something's happening very quickly, you know, that interactions that may not have started as a call for service, but, you know, you're sitting in your cruiser taking a report and something happens, you turn it on at the first reasonable opportunity.
So hypothetically, when they got the call to respond to this non-emergency, they should have turned their cams on then.
If not at the time they started driving there, at the time that they parked those cruisers, yes. Those cameras should have been turned on. Obviously, you know, if you're driving, that's, I don't know that anybody wants to see that footage.
But there were two people, they weren't both driving. And, I don't know, did they come in two separate cruisers?
I believe so. Most cruisers, particularly at overnight, are one officer cruisers.
Gotcha. And then there was something about the dash cam, Nick Evans. Is there a different rule for that?
I think Bethany would probably know this better than me. Coming from the police statement, they describe it as not being engaged because the emergency run lights hadn't been turned on. So my assumption would be that, you know, once those lights go on, the camera goes on.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
And that's the way it's designed that way, right, Bethany?
Yes, that's correct. The dash camera is set to automatically come on when the lights or the siren or any combination thereof are on in the cruiser.
But the as far as the body cams go, they need to do those themselves.
Yes, those are manual.
And do we know manual how so? Is it just a button they push on their chest or something, or...
I believe it is just a button. It's a button or a switch of some kind on the camera, and the camera is affixed to their uniform in the chest area.
Okay. Mayor Ginther asked Columbus Police Chief Thomas Quinlan to relieve the officer involved of duty and to have him turn his badge and his gun. And is this the same as being placed at administrative leave, Bethany? Is this standard operational procedure?
This is not standard operating procedure. Administrative leave, you are still able to, if, you know, depending on the circumstances, potentially work desk duty or, you know, answer phone calls. You know, there's different things that can allow for. Relieved of duty means that this officer has turned in his badge and his gun, has no police powers. So he is effectively an employee of the police department, but he is not a police officer for the duration of this investigation and whatever outcome might come.
There was a delay in providing first aid. Do we know anything about that, Nick Evans?
I mean, until we see the video, I don't think so. Perhaps Bethany's reported on this a bit more, but you know, that is another thing that jumped out at me that was really, really disheartening. Kind of similar to what we have seen in some of these other cases where, you know, somebody is hurt or injured or killed by police, and you know, they simply do not go to render aid immediately as they are supposed to do.
Okay. I was going to say, Bethany, is there a policy on that score?
So the policy is that as soon as is safe and reasonable. So obviously if there were in some hypothetical circumstance, an additional threat, you would obviously want to not immediately render aid and take care of yourself so that you can render aid. Right. That wasn't the circumstance here. So we don't know how long that time gap is. That's something we'll see on that video. If whether it was seconds, whether it was minutes, we don't know what that is. But it was enough of a gap that the mayor did issue that statement saying it was a delay. So again, we don't know what that delay is, but it was significant enough that they felt it necessary to say.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are following up on the news that yet another law enforcement officer has shot and killed an unarmed black man. In this case, it was early Tuesday morning. The police officer, who has been identified as Adam Coy, an 18-year veteran of the force, responding yesterday to an early morning noise complaint, a non-emergency complaint. He did not turn on his body-worn camera until after the shooting. It captured the 60 minutes prior, but no audio. I'm talking right now with Columbus Dispatch reporter Bethany Bruner and also WOSU reporter Nick Evans. Coming up, as I said, we're going to have an expert on police use of body camera technology joining us. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the police officer turned on the body cam after the shooting. The body cam then had already pre-recorded 60 seconds of the event. No recording. At the point where he turned it on, at that point in time, was there audio then, Bethany?
There should be. Okay. There might be a second or two lag. Just obviously technology isn't as awesome as we want it to be every time, but there should be audio at some point in that immediate after the turn on.
And the video is supposed to be released after the family has seen it. Nick Evans, any news on when that's going to happen?
We've heard whispers about an early afternoon press conference, like aiming for, you know, sometime little afternoon today to show us the video. But, you know, I haven't seen like a specific release giving us an explicit time. We know that the attorney general yesterday asked for a little bit of delay as well. We're expecting it today, but we don't know the exact time that is going to come out.
What's the typical protocol, Bethany Bruner, when it comes to releasing video?
So it's typically in the hands of that investigative agency, whichever lead investigator, whether it's Columbus Police, the Sheriff's Office, BCI, to determine when and how to release that footage. That footage is part of the investigation, so they make that call. In this particular instance, they are releasing that very promptly after the shooting. Within 24 hours, or within 24 to 36 hours is exceptionally quick.
Okay.
So this is, they're trying to be as transparent with the public as possible on this.
And the BCI folks, or the Attorney General, BCI works for the Attorney General, said, as Nick said, that they want to delay the release until after they'd questioned another officer. That I'm presuming that's the other officer that was on site.
We don't know that for sure, whether it was that officer or another officer that responded in the immediate aftermath of that shots fired call going out on the radio. They do want that slight delay to do that interview. That's not unusual for law enforcement to want to do that interview without that footage being out there. So there's no chance to, you know, line up stories and timelines.
Right.
Not that there's any allegation that they would do that, but
it's just a precaution.
Just to be safe. Yeah.
And Nick, did you want to say something?
No, okay, I was just agreeing. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. And Police Chief Quinlan was not at the press conference yesterday. Is that unusual, Bethany Bruner?
I don't know that it's unusual. You know, these instances, you see a variety of responses in terms of who appears at the press conference and who doesn't, and who speaks and who doesn't.
Yeah, Public Safety Director Ned Pettus was there. Yeah.
You know, I asked the mayor directly yesterday at the press conference, why is Chief Quinlan not here? And we did not get an answer to that question. So, you know, there is speculation that Chief Quinlan might be in the hot seat with his job, but there's been no official word from City Hall. And he did have a statement in the print release that was sent out to media yesterday.
A pretty detailed and extensive statement, I thought.
Right.
For the police on such an incident. The mayor did not answer a question, and I don't know if you asked this, Bethany, or not, but or maybe you, Nick Evans, about his confidence in the chief. What do you make of that?
Right. So that wasn't me, and forgive me, I don't recall the name immediately, but it was a reporter from, I believe, NBC4 that asked that question. And you're right to point it out, because it jumped out to me as well. You know, the reporter asked, you know, do you have confidence in Chief Quinlan to you know, run this agency? And the mayor very explicitly sidestepped that and said, I'm committed to a full and transparent investigation. So I think that, you know, even going back to the protests over the summer, the mayor has been expressing, and other city leaders have been expressing, some real frustration with how the department has been run. And I think that this definitely adds to it.
Yeah. Bethany, what do you make of that lack of, you know, the at least not even responding to the question about confidence?
You know, I think sometimes what you say is not in actually the words you use. And I think that in this instance, that is a very telling sign. We know the chief is still in that first year probationary period. So, you know, it's anybody's guess what the conversations are behind closed doors in City Hall right now. But, you know, there's definitely at least a public expression through the words that are not being said of how the mayor feels.
Unlike after Casey Goodson Jr. was shot and killed by a sheriff's deputy a little less than 3 weeks ago, the handoff to the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation was immediate this time. And do you think that's in response to the what some people see is kind of a mess up in the last instance?
So no, I don't. So this summer, following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the mayor and police have entered a memorandum of understanding with BCI that any shooting, both fatal or non-fatal, involving Columbus police is to be investigated by BCI. So this is for a shooting involving a Columbus police officer, standard operating procedure now.
Okay.
This is not in direct response. That was in place well before the Casey Goodson shooting took place. So this is not in response to that. This is just their standard operating procedure now.
And Mayor Ginther has called on U.S. Attorney David DeVillers to review the case from a civil rights standpoint. That is going on right now with the Casey Goodson Jr. case. What in that case, there was a question about who is actually in charge of the investigation now. David DeVillers suggested that he was. There's questions about that now. What's going on there, Bethany?
As far as we know, this is BCI's investigation, and the way the mayor phrased it yesterday was that he has asked the U.S. attorney to review the case, which would at least imply that there will be the BCI investigation, and then the U.S. attorney's office would look at that investigation for possible civil rights violations at some point once the investigation is further along, if not complete.
Yeah, I mean, these would be completely separate charges too, you know. So my assumption would be that they would be operating in parallel or one after the other, like Bethany described.
Bethany, what's the community saying? And correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, there were not demonstrations last night there may have been small ones. I know at the press conference there were demonstrators, but what's going on with that?
So we have not seen anything pop up in terms of events being planned or organized. Obviously, Christmas is Friday, so that is throwing a proverbial wrench into those organizing plans. Obviously, people want to spend the holidays however they can this year. But, you know, we are expecting either this weekend or next week to start seeing some of those demonstrations pop up on a larger scale.
Okay. And anything you've heard, Nick Evans?
In terms of like actual demonstrations, no. I mean, there are, you know, local leaders that are starting to put out statements. I mean, we heard from Stephanie Hightower, who leads the Columbus Urban League. Quote, she echoes the rage of the mayor and the council and their grief and their calls for certain justice. And quote, we can't restore these men's lives. All that's left to us is to ensure that truth ultimately prevails.
Okay, I'm going to take Charles in London. Charles, we're running out of time, but go ahead.
Yes, in a former life, I was an enlisted private in the Army Reserve, so I understand culture. And what bothers me about the whole situation is the contextualization of what could have happened before the shooting. And so in Afghanistan, if a Talibani kills soldiers, kills Marines, blows up something, as soon as he is unarmed and surrendering or no longer a threat, for a soldier to kill him is a clear and obvious war crime. There is less of a standard for police in this country to employ deadly force than there is for our soldiers in the field. And I wanted to ask Bethany about the culture of the Columbus Police Department, because neither one of these officers turned on their camera. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to a deeper culture of what is wrong with this whole situation.
Okay.
And we have to be careful how we characterize the lethality of an incident, because that's irrelevant. What's relevant is the threat at the time of the lethality. It doesn't matter what he said. It doesn't even matter what he did. If he's no longer a threat, then that's the issue. Have a great day and happy holidays.
Thank you, Charles. Same to you. Okay, I think, a lot of people ask that, and I've asked it before, too. Why can't they just shoot his foot? Why can't they shoot his knee out? I mean, why do they have to shoot to the torso, shoot to kill? There are reasons for that, but I think Charles makes a really interesting point, given his time in service.
Yeah, and that training is the center mass of the body, because that is the part of you that is going to stay still the longest if you're moving.
Yeah.
You know, it's really easy to wave a hand, wave a foot. It's a moving target and you're less likely to get a result or hit somebody or something you're not intending to. So that is why they are trained to shoot center mass. That is standard across police departments, across the country and across the world. In terms of why they may or may not turn the camera on, We don't know that answer. We know they turned it on within 60 seconds of the shooting occurring because that 60 second look back did capture it. But we don't know.
How long before that they were there. So we don't know how long, or do we know anything about the time span between when they arrived at that place and the shooting occurred?
We do not. We do not know how long it happened, how long they were there. How much they had talked to this gentleman, if they had talked to other people before they'd gone there, if they talked to the person who made the complaint. We know none of that at this point.
Yeah, Nick?
If I can go back to just the idea of why not shoot him in the foot or the knee or something. You know, I think one of the things that I hear from, you know, a lot of folks that I've interviewed about this is why shoot, period? You know, I mean, it in so many of these instances, you know, you have a threat neutralized. You know, there is not a clear and present danger to the officer, to the perception of almost anyone who is not an officer. Now, I've certainly heard from officers that, you know, they feel threatened in these situations. And I don't want to just simply reject that. But you know, I think a lot of neutral observers have begun to sort of like get together and just say, like, this is not reasonable what is happening. And I mean, in an instance like this, you know, the idea that the like a service weapon is the response in this situation is, I think, kind of the argument that the folks who I know we're we're really frustrated with this word, but the defund the police folks are mm-hmm. saying, like, you know, if it wasn't a police officer there, there's no way that this could have happened. You know, maybe it didn't even require a response in the first place. We really don't know the circumstances at all. I mean, some of the statements seems to suggest it was just a guy at somebody's house who was expecting him to be there.
Yeah.
But you know, there is just this, I think, too much of a tendency that a lot of folks are seeing for firearms to be used in these interactions.
Mm-hmm. That's Nick Evans, 89.7 NPR News reporter, and also with us, and I have to say goodbye to Bethany Bruner, Columbus Dispatch reporter. Bethany, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays, Ian and Nick.
Happy holidays, Bethany.
And we will continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, we're following up on the early Tuesday morning shooting by a Columbus police officer of an unarmed Black man after responding to a non-emergency early morning noise complaint. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
The city of Columbus, the people of Columbus, invested more than $5 million to outfit our officers with body-worn cameras. They have proven to be a valuable tool to the community and officers alike for situations just like this.
That's Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther speaking at a press conference yesterday after a Columbus police officer shot and killed an unarmed Black man after responding to an early morning non-emergency noise complaint. The officer failed to turn on his body-worn camera until after the shooting, capturing about 60 seconds of video, but no audio. Ginther said what footage was captured would be shown to the man's family, then released to the media later today. Still with us is 89.7 NPR News reporter Nick Evans. Joining us is Daniel Lawrence. He's a principal research associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit social and economic policy think tank in Washington, D.C. He is an expert on police use of body camera technology. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've read some of the news coverage about this case. What details about body-worn cameras caught your attention in this case?
Well, of course, you've already talked about what we refer to as a buffering period. So that's typically a 30 to 60 second video only collection of the footage. When the officer activates the camera, it pulls back that period of time. There's no sound associated with that, but that's obviously going to be a pretty critical component of the investigation into how this shooting occurred.
How do the body cams work? I mean, it's 1:30 in the morning in this case. How much light do they need?
They work pretty well in low light situations, and they're a fish-eyed lens, so they capture a pretty wide view. There are different placements of body-worn cameras. The Columbus, Ohio Police Division sounds like they have the chest-mounted ones, so that can be an issue where if an officer puts their back to a wall while they're going around a corner and they peek out from the corner, you don't see what the officer's seeing. There's other placements of cameras on their shoulder, their collars, as well as they can connect them to glasses. The ones that are connected to the head are the best for investigations because you get that first-person perspective of the officer's view.
And Nick Evans, all the ones that are used in the Columbus Division of Police are the ones that are on the chest?
Everything that I've seen has been a chest-mounted camera, yes.
And I'm wondering, Dan Lawrence, about that 60-second look back, I guess. If it goes back 60 seconds, that means that it's on without being activated?
Right. The cameras are always pulling footage. And I'll also have to say that in my experience, I haven't come across a department with 60 seconds. In most departments, it's 30 seconds. So I actually commend the department for having a longer buffering period. And that affects storage, which affects costs. But it is, in this case, critical, as I mentioned, to have that additional time to really capture that.
And is there a typical policy out there, Dan, that about when officers should activate their cameras or deactivate them?
Across the board, I would say the standard policy is when there's a face-to-face interaction with a community member, officers are expected to have their camera activated. The Urban Institute has done an evaluation of officers activating cameras in Anaheim, California. And I'll note that this was for a pilot study of the first 6 months that the department used body-worn cameras. But we examined different police activities and when officers are most likely to activate their body-worn cameras. And I'll note that the call that the Columbus officer was responding to is essentially a disturbance call, a noise disturbance. What we found in Anaheim that officers are about a third as likely to activate their body-worn camera for disturbance calls when compared to violent crimes. In Anaheim, we found that officers are primarily activating their crimes when there's a likelihood of evidence being collected with the case. So they're using these tools as evidentiary value, but for instances where it's not a violent crime, property crime, or just something that's more volatile, they're not as likely to activate it when they're responding to the call.
Let's see. Robert in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Happy holidays, everyone.
Thanks. Go ahead, Robert.
My question is, why is American law enforcement allowed to use ammunition that's banned by NATO? You was talking about the lethality of the shooting. Well, when they're using hollow points instead of ball rounds, you're almost guaranteeing to kill someone.
Versus disable them.
Right.
If that's what you're
going
for.
A ball round, it's going to go through round.
Okay.
A hollow point, it separates and spreads out.
Right. Robert, thanks for that call. Any insights, Nick Evans, about the kind of ammunition that's used? Is it pretty standard?
I really have no idea, okay, to be perfectly honest with you. The idea of using rounds that are specifically known to, expand as they enter someone's body. It's a pretty reasonable question. I remember being a little kid and hearing about, people in Congress complaining about hollow point bullets being something that people committing crimes had in an effort to try to make them harder to get for the public. So I wish I had more to say on it, but it is, I can understand the frustration.
Dan Lawrence, the mayor made the point that the city's invested $5 million in these things, these body cams, but what does your research tell you about whether or not or to what extent they are useful or is only as good as the people using them?
Yeah, it's the latter. So there's been body-worn camera research has really taken off in the past half decade or so. It's a technology that was originally broadly implemented back in, I'd say, around 2015 when the federal government released approximately $23 million to law enforcement agencies across the country to implement body-worn camera programs. So the research, that's young in the terms of, the grand scale of looking at and examining an issue in the social context. But that being said, there has been a lot of research, and depending on the outcome that's been looked at, there are some promising things, and there are some things that really haven't occurred as expected. So the most promising is what we found is a reduction in citizen complaints. So officers who receive body-worn cameras are less likely to have citizen complaints against them. The Urban Institute conducted a randomized control trial in Milwaukee, for example, and we found a 50% reduction in citizen complaints. Other cities had found similar large reductions in citizen complaints. And there's really two theories behind this. before, you know, the empirical evidence started supporting this, the idea was that there was going to be a civilizing effect, that both the officer and community member, because they know that there's a video footage being recorded of their interaction, they're both going to treat each other in a more civilizing fashion. So that is, there is some support for that notion. But there also is evidence that because now there's footage of body-worn cameras of a police community interaction, community members might be a little bit more reluctant to lodge a complaint, because in some states, they can actually be charged with a crime if their complaint doesn't line up perfectly with what the investigation finds. And so they're notified of this when they're making a complaint. And if the officer, for example, the sergeant tells them that, well, I looked at the footage and it's not lining up with what you told me, they might be a little bit more reluctant to file that official complaint. Other outcomes that are a bit more mixed, use of force. So early studies, and the prominent study that really got body-worn cameras going in this country was a study done in Rialto, California, that found about double the amount of use of force incidents that happened with officers who didn't have body-worn cameras. That really got the ball rolling, and it was a large reduction in use of force. More recent studies that are much larger, many more officers, a bit more rigorous in the methodological design, have found much more mixed results. So the Urban Institute study in Milwaukee, we didn't find an impact on use of force. Washington, D.C. had the largest randomized control trial with 2,000 officers. They didn't have an impact on use of force. Las Vegas actually had a reduction in use of force, but it was pretty moderate. I think it was around 8 to 13%. So not the large scale reductions that a lot of people were expecting.
Do we know, Dan, how police officers or law enforcement officers in general feel about wearing body cams, how comfortable they are with it?
In my experience, we've done interviews and focus groups with police officers, both before and after they receive body-worn cameras. The officers, prior to getting cameras, they're pretty concerned. They see this as a tactic for supervisors to conduct phishing expeditions and really try to find negative or bad behaviors that they're doing. That doesn't really happen, and that's the promise of body-worn cameras, the promising nature of body-worn cameras, is that they can hold officers accountable, but that's not really happening as it should be right now. That being said, so officers who then get cameras, they're pretty, they like them. They see them as another way to protect officers, have the viewpoint of the officers. It's not uncommon for officers to respond to an event and get out of their cruisers and immediately have people in the community pull out their cell phones and start recording them. So officers see the body-worn cameras as another metric for their accountability and their perspective of an event.
We're going to get back to our conversation. We're talking about body-worn cameras by police officers in light of the recent shooting by a Columbus police officer, shot and killed a black man. It occurred early Tuesday morning when the officer was responding to a non-emergency disturbance call. The police officer has been identified as Adam Coy. He's an 18-year veteran of the force. The victim we know is 47 years old. That's all we know at this point, and we expect to know more by the end of the day. Still with us is WSU news reporter Nick Evans, and also with us, Daniel Lawrence. He's a principal research associate in the Justice Policy Center of the Urban Institute. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit social and economic policy think tank in Washington. He's an expert on the police use of body camera technology. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the officer-involved fatal shooting of a black man that occurred in Columbus early Tuesday morning. Neither the victim has not been yet identified. The shooter is Adam Coy. He's an 18-year veteran of the force. Details about what happened are sketchy. The officer wore a body camera but did not turn it on until after the shooting. The police use of body-worn cameras became a widespread practice after police in Ferguson, Missouri, fatally shot Michael Brown in 2014. Still with us is 89.7 NPR News reporter Nick Evans. Also, Daniel Lawrence. He is an expert on police use of body camera technology. He is with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Daniel, what do you look for when measuring the effectiveness of body cameras? What are your criteria? Is it, you mentioned that deadly force incidents did go down in some places and not in others.
Sure. So that was just in use of force in general. So that can involve, you know, as much as putting cuffs on a person, depending on the department defines it.
Gotcha.
But we've also looked at other things, like, for example, we examined officer-initiated activities in Milwaukee. So these are the these are the events where the officer is proactively deciding to do something outside of a 911 call for service. And we found that body-worn cameras actually didn't change the officer's overall self-initiated activities, but what did change was the makeup of those activities. So officers who received body-worn cameras were actually they conducted 8% fewer subject stops. So these are the street checks that can be highly volatile because it involves an officer stopping a person and just briefly containing them for a moment. And there's a lot of potential for things to escalate in those types of events. Alongside the reduction in subject stops, we found that there was a 23% increase in parks and walks. So this is a very community oriented type of activity where officers park their cruisers, get out of the car, and walk around the community. So we see this as a good thing for body-worn cameras. It's that it's reducing those potentially volatile situations and increasing more of a community presence. I will note, though, that where body-worn cameras need to really go is in regards to the more common, perhaps mundane interactions with community members, and having officers be held accountable for activities where they're disrespectful, where they're cursing at community members, where they're just not treating people as humanely as they should be. And that's, I really think that's the potential of body-worn cameras, is that sergeants and first line supervisors can review these footages in a systemic way that can help better identify if their shift is, you know, behaving as they should be as officers. And that doesn't currently happen. It is a fishing expedition if there is review of body-worn camera footage at all.
And Dan, what is the storage capacity for a body camera? We were talking earlier about how you were commending that the Columbus police have that automatic 60-second review portion, although it's without sound, because that's a storage issue. It costs money.
Right. And the cost is specific with the storage. I'll note that the directive from the Columbus Police Division is that for things like evidence and permanent records that a supervisor might decide needs to get stored, those types of things. And that can take a lot of space. The cameras themselves, they're relatively cheap, $600 to $800. Many vendors, I'm assuming Columbus Police Division has Axon cameras. I'm not sure if that's right, Nick, if you know. But the cameras, many vendors often will just provide cameras to the department for free, with the assumption or with a contract that the department then enters into a subscription-based model to store the footage in a cloud-based system. And it's the management of that footage where it can just quickly escalate to millions upon millions of dollars.
Oh, why is that? Why is it so expensive?
Well, like I mentioned, a lot of this footage is stored indefinitely. If it's marked as evidentiary, that's going to be stored with the case indefinitely. It's also a cost associated with the district attorney's office, which is a separate cost from the police department. So there's city costs associated with that aspect as well, because they'll use footage in different ways.
Okay.
When footage needs to be released, like in this current case, there are special reviews that are necessary. There are privacy concerns. There might be redaction that's necessary, and redaction takes a lot of time and money to blur faces, to blank out prescription pill bottles if the officer enters homes. That there's a lot of consideration that goes into that for the protection of people in numerous different ways.
Can body cams be operated remotely?
So yes and no. So one company, one vendor, I believe it's Utility, their body-worn cameras are a little bit more advanced than the behemoth in the field, which is Axon. So Utility cameras have the capability of notifying a supervisor, a sergeant, if the officer is suddenly, like, perhaps they're shot and they're laying on the ground. An alert will, there's like similar to your cell phones, it can tell that the person is now laying down. An alert will be sent to the supervisor that that has happened. There's other things that are currently being released into the field that are going to hopefully help supervisors as well as communities in regards to body-worn camera footage. So the automation of activating the cameras. So there's things called smart holsters. So if the officer pulls their gun, the camera, if it's not already on, automatically turns on. There's also, you know, if they turn their sirens on in their cars, camera automatically turns on. There's systems for if the officer exits their vehicle, the camera automatically turns on.
The one and on their body, on their body cam. You're talking about body cam. Okay, go ahead.
And so in this instance with what happened in Columbus just yesterday, I mean, that would have been perfect where the officer got out of their car and it was already activated right at the scene as it should have been.
I've got time for at least one call. Dan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My question relates to some of the things you've been talking about, but I'm wondering, has any study been done here in Columbus of how often they have their cameras on when they should have had their cameras on? In other words, check, you know, all of their calls and then see where their cameras on. And then you find out, you know, that X percentage of people don't have their cameras on enough and so on. And then you take action.
Yeah. Okay. Nick Evans, what about what Dan's asking about in Clintonville? Do they review the use of the body cams?
I am not aware of a study like that. That's not something that I've heard about.
Dan Lawrence?
Yeah. So like I was mentioning before in our Anaheim study, and we're currently conducting one in Milwaukee as well. This is the issue of activation. So what do officers activate their cameras for? And officers do have a lot of discretion on when they should and shouldn't activate their cameras. And there are a lot of reasons around that. Deactivating a camera during a domestic violence interview with the survivor, for example, that there are serious privacy issues there that maybe the officer doesn't want to record, or maybe the person said, I don't want to have this recorded right now. So they might deactivate it. But as I mentioned with the Anaheim study, we primarily find that officers are activating their cameras when responding to violent and property crimes. Other activities such as assisting the public, traffic stops, minor crimes, disturbances, suspicious persons or activities, all of those are far below activation levels of those responding crimes. And that, as officers become more accustomed to using their cameras, muscle memory comes into play, policy, just knowledge comes into play, you see an increase in body-worn camera activation over time. And I know with Columbus, the directive has at least been in place since the end of 2016. So cameras have been in play for a long time at this point. Mm-hmm. And I was most surprised too, hearing that, you know, it wasn't just one officer that didn't activate their camera. It was both in two separate cars. That gets more at a cultural issue from my perspective, that two officers in separate vehicles are both responding. And the directive is that they're supposed to activate cameras when they get to the scene, if not on the way to the scene, and neither of them did it.
And as far as activating a camera, this is like a button you push or like a switch you flip. Is it that big of a deal to turn them on?
It's a double tap on the chest, on the button, and then there's typically an audio cue every minute or so just to let the officers and people know that it's still recording.
It's still recording. Okay. Well, Dan Lawrence, we're out of time. I appreciate your time so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Lawrence, he is an expert in body cam technology. He is a principal research associate at the Justice Policy Center of the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. And also with us, Nick Evans. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
You bet. That's 89.7 NPR News reporter Nick Evans. Thank you, everybody, for listening today. Take care. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.